Next is this guy that none of you have ever seen or heard of before. So I better clue you in on who this character is. Michael Beale is a lifelong record collector and is professor of radio TV at Morehead State University in Kentucky. A member of ARSC since the year I was born, Dr. Beale has only missed one conference in 36 years. He's a past president of ARSC and five times conference program chair. He's also been on the forefront of technological innovation here at ARSC in the program. 30 years ago, he introduced the technique of using color 35-millimeter slides to show the labels of the records he was playing. When color copiers arrived, he modernized to overhead transparencies, and now, kicking and screaming all the way, he has fearfully moved into the 21st century and the age of PowerPoint. So that he might be free to ring your chimes, he has entrusted the button pushing to his daughter, Leah Beale, a grad student in TV production at Brooklyn College. Her MFA thesis project will be a documentary about record collectors, so I'm told she might be asking you to be in her movie. So without more ado, here's Mike Beale.
Ladies and gentlemen, you were a wonderful audience, just wonderful. And I'm looking forward to seeing you all here in the studio again.
You'll never see me again, Bub.
What?
I wouldn't sit through another one of your shows if I was in the front row. Your guest star was Sally Rand, her balloon had a slow leak, and my wife wasn't with me.
Well. Look here, mister, you're too fresh. You know, you'll never get tickets to my show again.
What tickets? Last night I'm walking down the street, a guy throws a sack over my head, gives me a bump on the noggin, and when I come to, I'm sitting here in a studio.
Gee, I know my producer wants all the seats filled, but I wish he'd stop using that blackjack, you know?
Jack, do you mean to say the only way you can get an audience is to have your producer go around hitting people on the head?
Well...
Gosh, and I always thought before we go on the air that bong, bong, bong were chimes.
No. No, Mary, that's three more coming in. Last week, one guy's head was out of tune and loused up the whole network. But we just give them a light tap on the head. It only raises a little bump.
Little bump?
Yeah.
My bump's got snow on it.
I mean, well, don't blame the weather on me. Anyway, mister, the show is over, so you can go.
Okay. This is the last time I pass NBC without a helmet.
All right.
The sound of the NBC chimes is one of the most recognizable musical signatures in the world, or at least in the United States, or at least among us old fogies in the United States. These three notes are legendary. As an important trademark of an important company, it would be assumed that its history and its implementation would have been well documented by the company. Indeed, NBC does have an official explanation of the history of its chimes. But much like the public usually hears about the trademark of a sister company, the His Master's Voice picture used by RCA Records, the official story is wrong. And most of the other versions of the story, which have been written by researchers and historians over the years, like Eric Barnow, Robert Morris, Rod Phillips, and even Bill Harris, are likewise wrong. Why? Because they didn't have the recordings. I first realized that something was wrong with the accepted truth over 35 years ago when a friend of mine, ARSC member Rich Marco, gave me a pair of uncoated aluminum speakerphone discs that he had picked up in an antique store in Evanston. It was not that he was disinterested in them. It was just that he thought that I would be even more interested in them. You see, there was no music on them, or practically no music. And he knew that I was interested in studying early announcing styles. It was just a cooking show. It's the only known recording of the Mary Hale Martin show, which was on NBC out of Chicago in the early 1930s. Listen to the end of the recording, Rich told me. So I did.
You won't want to miss him. Remember to tune in next Wednesday morning to hear what Miss Martin has to tell you about emergency meals. This is Gene Paul King speaking. This program has come to you through the NBC studios in Chicago.
These are the New England Westinghouse stations, WBZ, WBZA, and W1XAZ of Springfield and Boston, Massachusetts.
Five chimes. This didn't jibe with any of the then-known histories. But there was no place I could find any verification. At the time, around 1970, this was the only known recording of its kind, and very few collectors of radio programs were interested in recordings this early. This is still pretty much the case, but fortunately, in the last 10 years, I've been joined in my quest by Elizabeth McLeod. She's taken over my job to become the de facto clearinghouse of early broadcast recordings. And as the two of us started to come across the very, very few other early recordings that contain NBC chimes, we realized that these recordings must hold the clues to the evolution of the NBC chimes. We were joined in this quest by Michael Shoshani, who was attacking the question from a different angle. He was collecting the chimes themselves. Much like some century-old music boxes hold the clues to the tunings used in European cities, these chimes show us what notes were played and sometimes what speed to play the recordings. You will see and hear today the results of our collective quests. I'll be playing every known pre-1933 recording of the NBC chimes, most of which have come either from Elizabeth or myself. And these will be recreated on the exact models of the chimes that were originally used on these broadcasts. Most of this, by the way, has been mounted on a website by Michael Shoshani, the NBC Chimes Museum. Just as the recordings will be shown as being the determining factor in putting melodies and dates to the changing practices of chime usage, knowing exactly which chimes were being used is the missing link to knowing what notes were used. This is vital in debunking the often stated theory that the selection of the notes G, E, C were selected to honor the partial owner of RCA, General Electric Corporation. Because dinner chimes only have a specific selection of four notes of three different scale notes, it will be shown that a three-note sequence of the pitch G, E, C was not used until late 1932, several years after GE had been forced to relinquish its participation in RCA. Michael Shoshani's study has shown that broadcasters generally use chimes made by the Deegan Company. Although they came in different looking configuration, there were three basic models used by broadcasters, each of which had a note configuration that was different from the other models, but were the same on different configuration of the same model series. The 200 series had the notes G, C, E, G. Although it could have been used for a G, E, C sequence, you will hear that it was used for 5- and 7-note sequences by NBC and had been used earlier on WSB for a 3-note sequence that was different. The 400 series had the notes E-flat, A-flat, C, and E-flat, with the C being an octave above middle C. This could not give a GEC sequence. This series had plates of identical length but varying thicknesses to change the notes. You will hear this model used in the Milwaukee recording of WTMJ. There is also a 300 series with the same tuning but plates of varying length and a less pleasing tone. A 500 series added a fifth note, an additional high A flat. The Model 20 was the premium model with a deeper and more resonant sound. The four notes were tuned to middle C, F, A, and C, an octave above middle C. This was the model that seems to have been used by at the time when the three-note sequence as CAF made its debut in 1931. The models 21 and 22 added a fifth note, a high F. There were other varieties, including a three-note version called the number 9 that had the notes C, F, and A. The most amazing variation found has a handle attached to it, with the notes G, E, C attached in that order. It's unusual to find a professional chime set with the plates in the order that NBC struck them, but this is common in the toy chimes NBC used for promotional purposes. Deegan chimes of this era were tuned to A equals 435, not A equals 440. And there's something wild. Here's a C above middle C on all three of these models. It's the only note that appears on all of them. This one is 20% flat. Oops. But back to the beginning. Within several years of the earliest broadcast, some stations were interconnecting and sharing special programming. The two most prominent chains were the radio group set up by RCA and the telephone group set up by AT&T. Many of their programs began and ended with an announcer reading the full list of stations. The only known recording of this practice was made of the opening of the second National Defense Test Day broadcast originating at AT&T's WCAP on September 12, 1924.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. We are about to broadcast from the War Department building at Washington, D.C., the addresses incidental to the Special Defense Test Day program. This is station WCAP, Washington, WEAF, New York, WJAR, Providence, WNAC, Boston, WOO, Philadelphia, WGY, Schenectady, WGR, Buffalo, KD, KA, Pittsburgh, WSB, Atlanta, WLW, Cincinnati, WGN, Chicago, KSD, St. Louis, WDAF, Kansas City, WLAG, Minneapolis, WOAW, Omaha, WFAA, Dallas, KLZ, Denver, and KGO, Oakland, California. Today is National Defense Test Day. And throughout our United States, in every city, village, town, and hamlet, were gathered citizens from all walks of life in answer to the Defense Day call.
Except during a long, continual program like this one, the individual stations were required to identify themselves every 15 minutes. Because an important part of the radio hobby was DXing, or listening to distant stations, many announcers used distinctive phrasing to make it easy for distant listeners to identify the station even under poor reception conditions. Notice how J.M. Witten emphasizes the S And Jefferson, in both of these recordings, made a year apart. What do I need here? Yeah, it's number five, yeah.
W.O.S. Jefferson City, Missouri. The King of the Ivories will play his famous interpretation of 3 o'clock in the morning.
Harry M. Snodgrass, who gained fame as King of the Ivories while broadcasting from W.O.S., Jefferson City, Missouri, will play the prisoner's song.
Some announcers, like the solemn old judge George D. Hay of WLS Chicago, combined unusual phrasing with an unusual sound, like a steamboat whistle.
WLS Chicago, the Sears Roebuck Station, presenting Ford and Glenn, our lullaby boys, in I Made a Hit with Kit, Kit, Kitty, and Kit Made a Hit with Me. Here we go.
There are unconfirmed reports that the GE station WGY did use chimes, but the most famous confirmed chimer was the Little Colonel, Lambton K. of WSB Atlanta.
WSB. The voice of the sound, radio phone broadcasting station. Of the Atlanta Journal, Atlanta, Georgia, announcing Ed and Grace McConnell, everyday Georgia folks, in one of their homemade cities, tote your load.
As you could see from the label pictures, if I had found that elusive one, those recordings were phonograph records from 1925 and 26, which recreated the typical announcements these announcers would make. This last record has a fascinating problem. You've just heard it at the normal speed we would consider playing a Columbia record of that era, 78, just below the 80 RPM their publicity specified. In it, you hear Lambton K. almost sing-songing the idea in a high monotone voice, WSB. But this is where Michael Shoshani and his chimes collection come in. The original chimes that K. used still exist and are on display at WSB, so we know they are a Deegan 200. And we know what pitch those four notes are tuned to. When I supplied this recording to Michael, he realized that playing the recording at normal speed would not allow the chimes on the recording to match the actual chimes. Amazingly, the recording would have to be pulled down to around 72 RPM to match. This changes the texture of the announcer's voice. He is now speaking the words in monotone with a very careful enunciation. And Ed McConnell's voice now actually more closely matches his familiar sound as the jovial host of Smile and Ed's Gang in the late 1940s.
WSB. The voice of the sound, radio phone broadcasting station. Of the Atlanta Journal, Atlanta, Georgia, announcing Ed and Grace McConnell, everyday Georgia folks, in one of their homemade cities, tote your load.
Yes, sir, folks, here we go, tote your load. Here, Georgia boy. Now, Mama and I will try to sing.
Harry.
WSB. The voice.
WSB.
More applaud Michael for that. More research needs to be done with the other very rare recordings made by Columbia during this Atlanta remote session, and the one other recording that Kay made in the 1920s for Victor, which unfortunately was never issued. But the intrinsic evidence of the limited notations of the actual chimes we know to have been used for the recording provides a unique determination of the recording speed and has literally changed an aspect of my study of the evolution of broadcast announcing styles. But now on to the other recordings that have changed the history of the NBC chimes. In late 1926, AT&T sold its broadcasting stations and wireline network to RCA. It provided the heart of the NBC Red Network, the former radio group, largely became the Blue Network. What practices those now formally established networks and their new competitor CBS used to identify themselves in the opening and closings of their programs is lost in the mist of time. They may have continued the cumbersome practice of identifying each station over the entire network, but this must have quickly become tedious when network programming became commonplace instead of something special. In 1979, writer Robert Morris reported that the two studios that NBC inherited from AT&T at 195 Broadway each had a set of four-note dinner chimes. Without citing any sources, he stated that until the operations moved to 711 Fifth Avenue in 1927, NBC Red identified themselves with a seven-note systems cue. According to Morris, after the move, both NBC Red and NBC Blue used a simpler three-note chime GEC. This cannot be confirmed because there are absolutely no known recordings from this period of time that contain systems cue chimes. But it can be disproved by the earliest known recording that does contain NBC systems cue chimes. Shortly after my dissertation was completed in 1977, Leah Burt of the Edison National Historic Site asked me if I wanted to go through the two wooden crates of test pressings that Theodore Edison had stored up in the site's attic. Would I? One of the many exciting recordings I discovered up in Tom Edison's attic that afternoon was the complete broadcast of the celebration of Light's Golden Jubilee, recorded off the air October 21, 1929, from the NBC Blue flagship station, WJZ New York. We just found out a couple of weeks ago that there is a Palafotophone film recording in existence of this up in Schenectady, recorded off of WGY. Now listen carefully as Graham McNamee in Greenfield Village will be cut off as he begins an extra sentence, proving that the chimes were not rung there, but could have been rung in Detroit, Chicago, or possibly New York. The WJZ ID is spoken by Milton Cross. Were the chimes rung for the network, or did Mr. Cross ring them himself for just WJZ?
Ladies and gentlemen, you were a wonderful. And ladies and gentlemen, you were a.
Mr. Graham McNamee will now make an announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, we bring this great program to a close. It has been our privilege here to watch the recreation this evening of the first practical electric light, and the privilege of the radio audience to hear something of that recreation. There is nothing for me to add, excepting just to tell you that this program has come to you through the National Broadcasting Company and Associated Radio Station.
This is WJZ in New York.
This recording proves that Robert Morris's theory that the three-note chimes began when NBC moved in 1927 was wrong. But exactly what is the melody we've just heard? Depending upon how carefully you listen or how carelessly it was struck, it could be a 5 or 6 or 7 note melody. There are 4 solid solo notes, but what was the final strike supposed to be? Was it a trill of the 3 notes? Or were all 3 notes supposed to be struck simultaneously, or was it supposed to be a 2-in-1 combination? Now, listen to the recording again if I... Well, no, I'll just play this because I have problems here. Now, this is what Michael thinks was actually done. Let's see if I can do it. Ah. Okay, he did it this way. Worked better before. Now compare this with a March 26, 1930. Middle station break in the Coca-Cola Top Notchers broadcast from New York on NBC Red, recorded over WEEI Boston. In addition to the chime sequence, notice something about this announcement which interrupts the program. The procedure at that time was for the announcer in the studio where the program originates, the studio announcer, not the program announcer, but the studio announcer, to ring the chimes, cut the feed from the rest of the network, give the ID of the local station in that city. The other stations taking the program would then have to be alert to give their own local ID in that short space. Now, Graham McNamee, or one of the studio announcers, probably gave a WEAF New York announcement, which had been cut off while we hear the WEEI Boston announcer. Then, after a pause, Graham will rejoin the network and start shilling for Coca-Cola. That's how Michael Shoshani does that four-finger ringing. Okay, here's Coca-Cola.
This is WEEI in Boston.
We'll stop our dance for a moment, and while the members of the orchestra pause and refresh themselves, let us relax in our easy chairs. Just the place to enjoy an ice-cold bottle of Coca-Cola.
Come on, folks. This was 1930. What do you think the band was relaxing with, despite what Graham McNamee said? In both cases, the first 4 notes are low G, C, high G, E. Then these are followed by the grouping of several of these notes struck closely together. Now, these 2 recordings also negate Rod Phillips' contention that the 3-note chimes were first used on November 29th, 1929, a thing that NBC seems to believe. Although the Edison recording from NBC Blue was a month before that date, the WEEI recording from March 26, 1930 shows that NBC Red was still using a similar chime set after Rod Phillips' date. Again, without the recordings, we would have no evidence. And speaking of evidence, now we come back to the recording that was my first evidence beyond the 3-note chimes. The Mary Hale Martin Cooking Show was broadcast from NBC Chicago on NBC Blue. And although the actual discs were discovered near Chicago, the recording had been made from the Boston and Springfield, Massachusetts synchronized stations WBZ, WBZA, broadcast probably in February or January 1931. For many years, I was unsure whether these chimes were network chimes from Chicago or local chimes from Springfield or Boston.
This program has come to you through the NBC studios in Chicago.
But then a few years ago, I think this is the ringing.
Wendell Hall, the pineapple.
Okay. But then a few years ago, Elizabeth McLeod got access to several programs by Wendell Hall, also broadcast from Chicago and sponsored by the same sponsor, Libby McNeil and Libby. This time air-checked on speakerphone uncoated aluminum discs from WTMJ here in Milwaukee. Now, this is the close of the February 4th, 1931 program.
The Picador has come to you from the NBC studios in Chicago.
Same notes. High G, low G, E, C, C. Played on the Deegan 200 chimes, but a little faster. I'm lefty. So these were Chicago chimes, but the Mary Hale Martin program was NBC Blue and the Wendell Hall program was NBC Red, and the chimes were the same. So either both networks used the same chimes, or the chimes denoted the city the broadcast originated in. Now, that theory gets some support from the opening part of the February 4th, 1931 Wendell Hall recording, where we hear a fascinating announcement with a four-note melody struck here in Milwaukee on a Deegan 400 chime set. That set is in a different key, so the notes are E-flat, C, E-flat, C. No, A-flat, C, E-flat, C. I think we have to skip ahead one. Yeah, that was what we just heard. Here's the WTMJ recording.
Milwaukee Journal Station, WTMJ. Becoming a part of the NBC network, we bring you at this time Wendell Hall, the Pineapple Picador.
Now, why are Milwaukee's chimes different? If the cities all use different chimes, how come there's absolutely no paperwork at NBC describing those rules? And no radio magazine article discussing it for the eager radio listeners? No letters to the editor asking for an explanation? Nothing. It is only in 1933, several years after the three-note chimes were definitely established, that the first existing memos on the subject of chimes are to be found at NBC. But these memos do not accurately spell out the earlier practices, despite their probably still being fresh in the writers' minds. So we're all left to wonder not only why did all these different strikes occur, but exactly what they, you know, when did they say, well, the hell with it, and went with three notes in the familiar 1-3-2 order. It did come somewhere in 1931, after the recordings we've already heard. The earliest recording existing with a three-note sequence occurs in the live middle station break in the Lucky Strike Hour of November 3rd, 1931. The first note is weakly struck, probably by announcer Auenbach holding the chimes in his hands as you hear Walter Winchell making fun of something that was either new and novel or had become old and annoying to him. To Winchell, chimes were chimneys, and Bach was that fellow with them. But exactly how long had they been doing that? We're still trying to find out.
Here's that fellow with the chimneys again.
WEAF, New York.
The first note was either weakly struck or else it was on a microphone that was not potted up quickly enough. Michael Shoshani says that for some reason this first note, the low C of CAF from a Deegan Model 20, often does not seem to pick up well, probably something about its waveform. I struck that extra hard. From that recording on, all of the recordings that have been found are of three-note sequences. And it wasn't too long before these three-note sequence became representative of radio the way no other sequence of other notes had become before. As proof, the December 11th, 1931 recording of the song Crosby, Columbo, and Valley by Dick Robertson for the assorted ARC labels ended with the three chimes pitched at CAF, as on a Deacon 20. Not GEC. And I only found this out about 2 days ago, which is why we don't have that recording ready. Until the previous two recordings that we did play, that our broadcasts were found, this next recording was considered for many years to be the oldest existing three-note chime recording. It's the Canada Dry program starring Jack Benny from May 2, 1932. It's also air-checked off of WJZ, but this time the program originated in New York. Let me just mention, because I didn't know whether we were going to have the chimes we put in the recordings of the modern strikes. Here's Benny.
Amos and Andy, in person.
Oh, did I skip one?
Yeah.
Sorry. Ah, okay. This one here, this is the one I skipped. This is the second one of the pre-Benny ones that had been found with the three strikes and only found, you know, in recent years. This March 24th, 1932, Amos and Andy broadcast originating in Chicago was air-checked off of WJZ on a very noisy Victor pre-grooved home recording disc.
We'll return tomorrow night at this hour. Except for them,
let's see if I can get this from the beginning. What am I looking for, 22?
Yes. Amos and Andy, in person, will return tomorrow night at this hour. Except for them, bid you all good night. This is Bill Hayes. The program has come to you from the NBC studio. WJZ, New York.
Now we should have the Jack Benny.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was the last number on our first program on the 2nd of May. Are you sleeping? Well, good night then.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are concluding the first program in a new series sponsored by Canada Dry. The ginger ale now available made to order at drug stores and soda fountains, as well as in bottles. Canada Dry has presented Jack Benny, Ethel Chute, and George Olson and his music. The same group of artists will be with you at this time Wednesday evening. Drums in My Heart, from Through the Years, is played tonight with the special permission of the copyright owners. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
WJZ, New York.
And I think we have a modern strike coming up. Okay, now that is different. That is from about a year later, another example of a hand-struck three-note chimes, this time using the GEC of a Deegan 200 chime set. This was from a Paul Whiteman program, April 17th, 1933.
Now we go back to that combination of rhythm and melody headed by the one and only Paul Whiteman. This time we hear Hustling and Bustling for Baby.
Yeah, let me get that together complete.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was the last number.
Yeah, here we go.
Now we go back to that combination of rhythm and melody headed by the one and only Paul Whiteman. This time we hear Hustling and Bustling for Baby.
That's how that recording was. One final example of a hand-struck chime, this time from the West Coast, originated program Hollywood on the Air, September 30th, 1933. Again, we hear a Deacon 20 chime set, CAF, but unfortunately, only the chimes. I think that's the modern. Okay, now, would you like to see what this looked like in a typical studio? We have a short film of Kelvin Keech doing a three-note strike in a Model 20 in 1933. It was edited into the opening of a movie short, Captain Henry Showboat, which featured Annette for the pre-baby boomer generation, Annette Hanshaw. We won't see her this morning, but here's Kelvin Keech. And note that that first note, the low C of CAF, does not sound very strongly. That's not there.
WEAF, New York.
So I told you it was short. For many years, okay, but by 1933, some things were already changing. Sometime in mid-1932, NBC engineers O.B. Hansen, seen on the left, and R.M. Morris contacted R.H. Ranger, seen on the right, to build a reed-based electronic chime machine. For many years, it was thought that the machines were first ordered and installed in 1933, but the Edwin Texaco Fire Chief Program from October 18, 1932, ends with the earliest known recording of a Ranger chime machine. The notes on this custom-built set of machines was GEC. All you will hear in this recording are the chimes. But since I dislike playing just an edited chime strike without something from the surrounding to properly authenticate it, I tried to hunt up the recording of that program to use instead of what was on the website. I don't have it, but I do have the next four shows. The recording of the following week ends before the chimes, but the other three contain the Ranger tone sounding. So here's the recording of the November 1st, 1932 program ending.
This is all I've got time for, Glenn.
All right.
Dear Chief, I had all my teeth knocked out in an accident and must get some false teeth.
Yes.
My wife saw me looking in the store window. I was trying to select some teeth and she pulled me away. Why did she do it? Signed, X Nutcracker.
Oh, my goodness.
Dear X Nutcracker, your wife was probably right in pulling you away from the store window where you were selecting your new set of teeth. She knows you must never pick your teeth in public.
Each week, the Texas Company presents over a coast-to-coast network Ed Wynn, the fire chief, supported by a cast of more than 50 artists, including Don Voorhees, the fire chief quartet, and Graham McNamee. Louis A. Witten, speaking for the Texas Company, extends this invitation for next Tuesday at the same hour. And whenever you hear the siren and bell, think of Texaco Fire Chief Gasoline. The Texaco Fire Chief program came to you from the stage of the Cass Theater in Detroit over the facilities of the National Broadcasting Company.
WEAS, New York.
So with these mechanized, chimeless chimes, we come to the modern era, the so-called golden age of radio. as very few recordings from the earlier era we just examined exist, and most old-time radio fans are not really interested in the relatively crude programming from before the mid-30s, it's these mechanized three-note GEC chimes and a later non-mechanized version that most radio fans remember. So therefore, naturally, I am less interested in these, and we'll leave it to the regular OTR fans to discuss. But there are interesting facts, especially concerning the mysterious fourth chime used to call NBC staffers for disaster cover. These, of course, are hand-struck. Now, for this part of the story and a recap of what we did today, I urge you to visit Michael Shoshani's website, the NBC Chimes Museum, for the most accurate details and the accompanying recordings that provide the proof to his facts. http://nbcchimes.info/info. These chimes, by the way, are courtesy of Michael, who lives in Chicago. We really were hoping that he would be able to be here this morning and ring them himself so I wouldn't have to be burdened with them. But something came up, and I stopped off yesterday and did pick these chimes up again. This is, since you didn't have a chance to really see it, this is the chrome version of the model 200. And sometimes these are even available with gold-colored plates. Sometimes they're in a box, sometimes they're not. And again, this is the big daddy of them all, the Model 20, and this is the Model 400, which was used here in Milwaukee. And this, by the way, this is a set that I own. It's not a Deegan chime. Was it Eagle Chimes? Yeah, which actually was made in Chicago, but it's an imposter and was not used by NBC. So we thank you.